Welcome to Take the Red Pill,
where we explore the realities within our reality.
We are your hosts, David Deere
and Donald Dalton.
This episode, Donald came up with a really interesting idea of a concept that he kind of came to him. So, Donald, I'm actually going to throw it to you right out of the gate and have you kind of explain the concept that you wanted to discuss in this episode.
Okay. Yeah, it was basically just an idea of our experiences color our personality and who we are so definitely, so distinctly from one another. The idea was, if we don't have experiences or we lose all memory of our experiences, is there a core part of us that still remains, or are we just the sum of our experiences?
Okay. And what was your takeaway on that?
My belief is that we actually do have a core of who we are, and experiences just build upon that core and shape that personality, our characteristics in that way. Kind of like the core would be a lump of clay, and our experiences from how we move and our choices and our beliefs and understandings and judgments and all that kind of stuff, we become more like the potter who moves it into that lump of clay into an ashtray or to a vase or to pretty much anything else that we can make.
Okay. So describe with less analogy, but more as best you can, what that core looks like. Because if we only have experiences as shapers of the clay, as it were, then what is the clay?
I think the clay is basically what we would define as our soul. Basically, before we came into this body and whatnot, it is the truest, most basic essence of who we are.
And what is, and how... How does one, what distinguishes the soul? What is the soul for one? And maybe that's kind of the whole crux of the conversation, what the soul is. What is the soul compared to my soul, compared to your soul, compared to Idi Amin's soul? If it's just a lump of clay, what is differentiates one lump from another lump? If there's no experiences there to color it or to shape it.
How is one widget different from another widget? In other words, you have an assembly line and you have the factory makes widgets. If everyone starts off as a widget, are you asking if there's a difference between the widgets that come off the assembly line, between you being a widget and me being a widget? Or are you talking about, or is that what you're asking?
Yeah, what differentiates one soul from another if there's nothing that has necessarily shaped it or defined it as of yet?
And see, that's the question I was thinking and pondering, and I actually have attempted to not start thinking about it, because I didn't want to jump ahead and be like, "Oh, I've thought about this for the past 2 weeks that we've been, haven't been recording." And so, the soul, as far as I understand it, is a piece of the divine, like a drop of water, dropped into a physical body. And that's when we have experiences. But I think the soul itself wants to have a multitude of experiences. And that's why it spreads itself out into drops, so that the divine can experience itself in a plethora of different areas. And I think the difference is in the way that the soul wants to experience. Like, if the soul says, "I want to experience Disneyland," then here's a piece of soul that's going to go to Disneyland. And the other part says, "I want to experience the Grand Canyon." Well, then the soul sets itself up so it has the basic characteristics that will allow it to experience Disneyland or the Grand Canyon to the best of its ability.
Okay, interesting.
To go forward with that, take Disneyland. It'd be like, okay, we incarnate, we have a body, and that's like we're walking into the gates at Disneyland. We get a map. We have people that say, "Hey, we can help you. We have information over here that can help us go where we want to go. We have food. We have all this stuff." And from the experiences that we have, like, oh, we're drawn to this ride over here as at this moment, as opposed to this ride over here, which is kind of like the whole life. And then at the end of our life is like us going out through the gates again.
The trickiest part about this conversation is when we talk about the soul as the lump of clay, as this kind of pre incarnate or precorporeal essence of who we are, or the core of who we are, it's hard to really talk about that individuated. It really is, because when you use the analogy of the drop of water, which I think is a really good one, the problem is that if you say, okay, who we are is this drop of water, right? But if you pull the drop from the ocean, you cannot distinguish the drop of water from any other part of the ocean, except for maybe just where it is in potential.
And there's individuality right there.
But there's no individuality until you've taken the drop out.
So there's no difference between the Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean? If you took a drop from the Atlantic Ocean and you took a drop of water from the Mediterranean Sea, if I understand what you're saying, you're saying that you wouldn't notice a difference.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if we're saying that David Deere, my identity is equivalent in analogy to a drop of water,
mm-hmm.
and my soul is analogous to the ocean from which that drop of water was taken, how do you find that drop of water while it's in the ocean?
Oh, I see what you're saying now.
And I'm saying that the soul is, it's a very similar idea.
So basically, if we go on that idea, then we do not become individuals until we separate ourselves from the larger pool of the divine and our larger soul part. And basically, until us as a drop of water removes ourselves and disconnects ourselves and separates ourselves from the ocean as itself, then we're saying that we have no individuality.
I'm saying that to a great degree. I think that's too simplistic. I think it's probably more complex than that. But I do think that is the case. I think that the whole idea of human existence and human consciousness is that in and of itself, is the whole experiment and intention is to have ourselves removed from source so we do not identify ourselves as source. And that is what creates the sandbox.
So are you saying there's only one soul that every living thing comes from, or can there be multiple souls?
Well, if we're using the ocean as an analogy, if you take a dropper and place it in the ocean, in the, let's say, the Caribbean Ocean, as opposed to the Indian Ocean, you're going to get different results when you pull the dropper out of those different areas of the ocean. So I would say that if the soul is just part of all that is, or if it's a blended sense of energies or resonances or vibrations of the all that is, it's just that particular vibration extracted from that portion of all that is.
So you're saying there's kind of a hierarchy of energy levels, of kind of like there is at the very top, there's all that is, that is, that is, and that is indistinguishable by itself. And then you go to, you drop down a level, and that might be where there's different souls, where that would be like different oceans. And then you drop down another level, and that would be like us as individual pieces of that soul incarnated here on Earth, going through our experiences and having a life.
Yeah, I think so. I think the difference is that it's the dropper. The dropper is a great analogy, and the reason I'll say this is because, like you're saying, the ocean, let's say that all that is like the ocean. And then you have the different oceans, because all the waters of this planet are interconnected in one way or another. And then within that ocean, you may have different currents, and you may have different eddies, and you may have different depths, and you may have different ocean streams, you know, the way the water kind of runs and flows. We also have rivers. We also have all these aspects of bodies of water. And then within that ocean or within that current, you might have different temperatures, et cetera, et cetera. But it's still, you can't differentiate one from another until you've actually taken the dropper and put it in and take it out. So that's what it is with us, is that it's us in dropper form. It's us removed from the source so that we can get a closer look at the energy swirling around in our own bodies and in our own experiences. So that's the tricky part about this, is when you say, are we a composite of our experiences? I just wanted to kind of look at the whole idea of the soul before we kind of moved forward to that, because I think it gives us a kind of a ground from which to work from.
I remember our first episode was on astrology, and one of the things that I had mentioned in that is that when we're incarnated into this lifetime, our astrology is kind of like our blueprint of our basic structure. Taking the water analogy, it's like, oh, this person has H2O, hydrogen, two hydrogen and one oxygen molecules put together. And then from that, that's when we start our experiences, and that's when we start adding molecules or taking molecules away. That's when we start, the clay starts to be molded from all of our experiences. Now, the interesting thing that I did think about was the whole idea of as above, so below. And if we go with that whole idea, then let's say, for instance, that tomorrow I woke up and I had absolutely no mental or emotional memory of my life up until this point. My body, on the other hand, has experienced life up to this point, and has basically, I have a couple scars here and there from a few accidents that I've experienced over my lifetime. Those scars are still going to be there. And so it's kind of like the physical body still has signs of having certain experiences, and it's affected by that. Whereas I'm thinking, would the soul, would our spirit, would who we are still have the same type of thing where, regardless of whether we were unable to remember it or if we lost all of our emotional baggage and thoughts, would we still have the effect of those experiences in one way or another?
I would say to some degree. And the reason I say to some degree is because, and I've thought about this many times. I had a discussion with a friend of mine, and he always said that there is a ultimate reality and an ultimate truth. He believed that there was one truth underlying all truths. So, I call it the court of law idea. In other words, it could be substantiated in a court of law because this actually happened. No matter how the history books write it, he said that there is an objective reality in which all things do happen inviolately and concretely. That's his belief. My belief's a little bit different because I'm like, it doesn't really matter. You've heard me say this before. If I think that, let's see, if I think that's, trying to think of a good analogy because I like to be Mr. Analogy.
Okay.
But my analogy palette is a little sparse. I think I've got pink and orange and not a lot you can do with that without really making something really ugly. So forgive any schools that have the color pink and orange. That might be some of the school colors. If it is, I feel really bad for them. But nonetheless. Okay, analogy time. Let's see here. Let's say somebody passed. Let's say you had somebody passed that you were close to, and your last words with this person were pretty negative.
Oh, okay.
Right? So it's shaped kind of how you've been through that time without. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Now, even if you lose your memory from there on out, you've still been led to that point by that event that happened and your memory of it. Say you went to a medium, and the medium said, oh, yeah, this person... The person's spirit on the other side says, don't worry about your last words being angry with them because they don't really remember that as much as the whole beautiful relationship that you had. And from there on out, you remember the relationship fondly, and you've released the guilt and you've released the burden that you've carried for those harsh last words. That inviolately changes the past, in a sense. It changes who you are because your perception and your memory and your perspective changed on it. So that to me makes the ultimate reality, as my friend said, irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I'm saying is that is an example of human experience that may actually be affecting the reality rather than the reality affecting the experience.
So that almost sounds like regardless of what we do or what we experience at any given point, we're going to be who we're going to be regardless anyway. In other words... That sounds like predestination, pre-planned out.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay,
at all.
Okay.
And you know, if we're going
I know.
I'm going to grind my teeth on the mic. I think that's a cackle. That was almost an evil laugh. That was a chortle.
Yeah. I know we have different views on free will and predestination and stuff like that, but it just sounded like you're saying even if you don't have the emotional memory or the mental memory of that person passing and having said those negative words as being your last words to them, and then you end up going to somebody that says, oh, they're fine with it, then you're still releasing that energy, that emotional and mental energy, even if you don't consciously remember it. I'm saying, what if you don't have that emotional energy or mental memory whatsoever? In other words, there's nothing to release because you're like a hard drive that's been wiped clean. Absolutely.
Well, see, here's why I say that doesn't apply.
Okay.
Because, granted, let's say, let's take this. Let's give it as much detail as we can.
Okay.
Fred McMulderberry?
Yeah, Fred.
Okay, Fred McMulderberry had an argument with George Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
George Johnson died in a car accident. Fred McMulderberry's carrying around this guilt, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fred McMulderberry gets in a car accident, suffers severe amnesia, and has no recollection of this memory. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but not just mental memory, but emotional baggage as well.
Okay. So if somebody says George Johnson died in the car accident, he's like, I don't know who that is.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's say between the time that George Johnson died and then when he lost his memory, let's say that his wife, George Johnson's wife, he stopped having a relationship with George Johnson's wife. He stopped talking to her altogether.
Okay.
And it hurt her greatly. And then he loses his memory. That still hurt her. You see,
mm-hmm.
So the experience is still valid. Even if he doesn't remember it, it still occurred on the interaction between those two on a soul level. I mean, he could change the experience as he goes through life by his forgetting of it. And maybe he starts talking to her again, and then that completely reshapes that experience. But one preceded another.
Okay, so Fred McMulderberry originally lost his memory, and he's talking to George Johnson's wife?
Right.
Okay, after George Johnson has bit the dust.
Right. I feel like we're like recapping Real Housewives of Puxatawney or something like that.
That's okay, just as long as we don't go to the Jersey Shore.
Oh, yeah, no. No, you know, there's not going to be Pookies or Shookies or whatever they're
Snookies,
called.
Snookies, yeah.
Snooky, is that what she's called?
Yeah.
Okay.
We have to maintain some level of...
integrity.
Integrity, exactly. Okay, yeah. Sorry, Jersey Shore, but anyway, yeah.
I don't think any of them are listening to this podcast. And if they are, yay, keep listening.
We love everybody. Everybody is our friend.
That's right.
So basically you're saying that the interaction, regardless of whether we remember it or not, is still valid because of how it affects the people we're connected to and how we interact with them.
Exactly.
Okay, so the moment that we lose all of our memories and emotional baggage, we literally get to a point where we're very neutral with just about everything because we don't remember doing anything. Like, do you like avocados? What's an avocado? It's this thing. Oh, is that food? Yes, that's food. I don't know if I like that. Let me take a taste. Yes, I like avocados, or no, I don't like avocados, depending on your preference. At that point, when we become absolutely neutral, we would instantly be changing the interactions that we have with people to begin with. It would start us having experiences again that would start to build up our characteristics and our personality from that point on, even though it would be differently shaped. And the reason why I bring that up is because I still believe that there are certain promises, certain handshakes that we make before we incarnate in this life with other people to help us get through certain things, to help us experience certain things. And if we start again at that zero point, are we in some way failing some of those promises, or are we still able to live those out and produce them the way that we had originally planned, because at our core, we are still basically the same part of the soul?
I think at the zero point, that's very likely a marker, I think, an incarnational marker.
How so?
Would be my guess.
Explain.
I think if you ended up in a car accident and had severe amnesia, you probably plot that out in your life plan. And you say then I'm buying into predestination, but that marker is there if you are following the course for the lessons that you need to learn. I mean, since we have free will, we can completely rewrite everything. Shake the Etch-a-Sketch is what you're talking about. Is that if the Etch-a-Sketch gets shaken, well, I think it's only if you've gotten to the point where you've made all the choices to end up with an Etch-a-Sketch in your hand. Because of free will, we can make 1,000 different, million, infinite choices. And some of those choices may end up redirecting us from whatever that particular incarnational marker is. We're probably going to play bets and odds. I don't believe that anything is 100% chosen in life. I think the odds are pretty high, but I think it's a moving target, like you've heard me say before. Oh. So I think in that case where somebody loses their memory, I think it's because a series of choices have been made that kind of directed them onto that particular marker. Mm. If A and B and C and D and E conditions are fulfilled, then F, they get in a car accident and lose their memory.
Yeah. And you had said that would be kind of like a karmic incarnational marker, where if we do get back to that zero point, it's like, well, something that huge, we would have been able to at least have an idea that it could happen before we incarnated. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think what we do is, and now this is tricky because we're talking about the soul as if we're like, you know, with a chalkboard and a little map that we're drawing out. Okay, let's see here. Which I think there is kind of on an energetic level. But I think because we are not individuated on a soul level, we are able to understand how we can play with time. We are able to understand the inviolate connections between ourselves and other people. And the connections actually are as connected as your hand is to your face through blood and tissue and nerve endings. We're connected with other people in very similar ways, but it's just energetically. But of course, you know, we've got the skin that separates us all, and we don't really see that. You know, there's this idea, and I love this. I've quoted it before because I love Hoje Zay Chung from X-Files, where he quotes, I think it was Jesse Ventura.
Okay.
Says he played this guy, Men in Black, and he says, you still don't understand how two-dimensional projection from the retinas form three-dimensional reality. I'll put it in the show notes like I did the last time I referenced this. And basically, and I came across this too again, and I don't know if it was with Abraham Hicks stuff or not, but if it was an Abraham quote, but they're saying the same thing, is that we always say that we perceive things with our eyes, but rather our eyes are actually helping to create the reality around us. Hmm. And I think that what happens is when we're in non-corporeal form, we understand how we do that. We understand that when we come into this life, we say, all right, I'm going to throw you in and I'm going to let you go. And I'm going to let you see what you do. And you make your decisions based on this. If you make this decision, I want to have this experience on a soul level. I can't guarantee I'm going to have it, but I'm going to go for this and I'm going to try to set up the stage as best I can. So the experiences come, and I think the experiences don't define us. Like you say, do the experiences really define us? I think it's really more of the experiences are had, and they're brought back into the soup that is all that is.
Okay, I got to stop you right there, because if I remember correctly, there have been numerous episodes where we talk about how important having experiences are and how our growth and our ability to perceive more and more and even possibly get to a level of ascension is based or has at its core to a large degree our experiences. And now you're saying that experiences, no big whoop. So basically all the episodes that we've talked about how important experiences are, you're changing your thoughts and saying, they're not that important.
Well, see, that's value judgment words you're using, whether they're important or not important.
Well, see, that's a whole topic right there, is if we believe that our experiences are important, then who are we without our experiences? And can we be anything other than ourselves, even with our experiences?
Okay, I'm gonna answer that by taking us a little further back into this episode than we started it. The thing is we're clinging on to the identity so desperately here in this conversation.
Okay.
The identity is paramount and the identity is everything. But the identity is just really just a sack of garbage for all intents and purposes. It's a joke is what it is. I mean, it is. I mean, we're like, oh my God, it's me. It's I'm mad at mama. And then when you die, all of a sudden you find that you realize how much a part of everything that you really are. And you realize how much the I is really, there's not much to the I. It's really more of a we, and the lines get blurrier. I mean, haven't you ever heard those channeled entities always refer to themselves in plural?
Yeah.
Like, why? How are you going to do it? It's like me saying we, you know, because I'm speaking on behalf of all my cells. And each cell has a voice to get, and it says, okay, no, you're speaking for all of us at once, so say we. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I'm like, yeah, but I'm me. But the cells are like, no, you're not. You're us. You're a composite of all these cells here. And I think it's the same idea is that all we're doing is we're just making a contribution to all that is. We're taking all these experiences that we've had and we're bringing them home. We're bringing them home to the all that is and saying, all right, here we go. We're going to throw this into the pot. It's kind of like a soup. You know, you eat soup and it has a little bit of carrots and rutabaga and cumin and jicama and all this other stuff. You might say, I really taste the cumin, but you taste the cumin in regards to everything else that makes the soup.
Okay, let me see if I can present that a different way with the analogy, with the Disneyland analogy that I was using earlier.
Okay.
If I understand what you're saying, combining it with what I believe with promises and that we make before we incarnate with other souls and whatnot, with other spirits and souls, when we show up at the gates of Disneyland, that's kind of like when we're born. We're going to say, for example, that the soul wants to experience the, let's say, what's the name of a really good roller coaster? The Velocitor or something like that. Let's just say it's called the Velocitor. And the Velocitor is at Disneyland. Now, if you've ever been to an amusement park, you know that amusement parks are huge. They go on forever and ever and ever. Well, if I understand what you're saying, then the soul placing us in the gates at the gates of Disneyland is giving us a good chance to run into, to see the Velociraptor ride and to want to get on it and ride it. So, but through the experiences of our lives, we may stop off at the arcade, we may get some cotton candy, we may go over and see the birds or whatever, and we may ride the carousel first or a number of other different rides before we actually find our way to the Velocitor. And from what I hear you saying, it's more of, here's Disney World, we want to experience Disney World. Oh, and by the way, if you get over to the Velociraptor, that's cool, but it doesn't really matter. If just enjoy yourself here, and when you're done, when you come back out of the gates of Disneyland, you'll be able to share this whole experience with us of everything that happened, and we'll be so much richer for it because of that. To me, that seems to take out some of the importance of the connections that we have with other people that we meet in our lives, that we've made these negotiations, these promises, these contracts with before we incarnated. Are those still important, or does it really matter anymore once we get down here because of free will?
I think it's as important as we make them. I think they're important to the sense that we acknowledge their existence. They are what they are, and we're like, bravo. I think it's like this. We come back, and if we're doing our life review, if the question's asked, so what was the experience you had? What did you make of it? And you tell them, well, you know, these are some things I wish I could have done differently. And they would say, well, good. Okay, good. Or you could come back and you say, what did you make of it? Oh, I did this, and it's exactly where I wanted to do it. And they'd say, oh, good. You see what I'm saying? I think it's the same answer when you come back. It's really the experience is the thing in and of itself. It's like the play is the thing, this Shakespeare idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the experience is the thing.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, that at the end of life, you know, when it's life review and everything, there's no real judgment. It's just like, hey, you experienced. Yes, cool. I got that whole idea. At the same time, I'm looking at it as, well, it's like you and I. We have this understanding between us that on a regular basis, we will get together and connect to record this podcast.
Okay.
Now, what if all of a sudden one of us decided to say, or well, to put our, make a set of choices that puts us in a position where we are no longer able to or no longer want to, then still at the end of the life review, there's no judgment or anything, but the understanding that we have between us could cause friction and or karma, and that would be part of the our shared life experiences. If we did not have this understanding then to begin with at all in the first place, then we would never have the opportunity to have any kind of friction in this project. And I'm looking at that with other people as well, because with all the interactions that we have, because you had mentioned that experiences are important, and from this episode to other episodes, it's just like episode or experiences are paramount. Experiences, I take them, leave them.
No, well, so. it's okay. It's like, it would be like saying, you know, it's, let's go back to the lump of clay, but let's take it actually you working with a lump of clay.
Okay.
It's, to me, it's like, what are you going to make out of that lump of clay? I think I'm going to make a horse. So you make a horse, right? And I'm like, that's a fantastic horse. And you're like, okay, great. Well, I just wanted to make something, and the horse is what I chose.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, good for you for making something. That's really what I'm saying about experience. I'm saying it is invaluable as just it is creating. The whole thing is about creating. Everything boils down to creating. And the thing is like saying the fish is swimming, and you're saying, well, you know, I have to applaud that fish for swimming. The fish is like, I swim. I'm a fish. That's what I do. I swim. Why are you applauding that? That's just what I do. And it's the thing with us. It's like we create. That's what we do. So to say, well, you know, it's a great accomplishment to experience, it is, but it isn't an accomplishment. But it is whatever, if we decide it is, then it is. If we decide it isn't, then it isn't.
So
but
what you're
here's the thing.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'll quickly take it to this. You said ascension, and I've been stuck on that since you said that. Ascension, we have the idea that, oh, when we raise in conscious and vibration, you know, and kumbaya and ascension, you know, and I've been thinking about the whole ascension thing. The ascension thing to me is more, nothing more than an awareness of how interconnected we are, an awareness of the interconnectedness of a certain aspect. And I think, truly awareness, that our identity, we realize that if I'm walking around saying I'm David Deere, the ascension is more like, oh, I'm not just David Deere. I inherently feel how interconnected I am with all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a realization. It's not necessarily we've changed everything. We've shifted. I mean, yeah, granted, it has changed and shifted, but it's not this goal. It's not like you get to ring the bell when you ascend. It's not like that, and you get the prize at the end. It's more like it's just a recognition of yourself on a certain level of divinity. You're already that. It's whether or not you recognize it. And I think when we go through these experiences, if you say, oh, you know, I had this friction with this other person, kind of like what you were saying,
mm-hmm.
I had this friction with this other person, we had these life agreements worked out. If we have these frictions with these other persons and we realize what we were able to create from that friction, and then that creation brought us even closer to the awareness of our own divinity, then that's the ascension. The ascension is not us going up a level. It's the ascension is realizing that we're at a bigger level than we thought we were in the first place.
Oh, okay. I know that we did a whole episode on ascension, so I wasn't going to go back with the whole definition of that. But I like how you put that. I like how you put that really good. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
So what if I understand what you were saying earlier, at the core of who we are, whether we have memories and emotional baggage of any experience or not, at our core, we are creators.
Mm-hmm.
It's in our nature to create, regardless of how much remember or how much baggage we've accumulated or how many experiences that we've had.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we get back to that zero point, the moment we hit that zero point, we may create the experience of eating mud because we don't remember having eaten mud when we were a kid. It's like, oh, we're creating mud pies. Okay, we're creating. And you're saying that if nothing else, we will always be doing some form of creation regardless.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Is that the only thing, though?
No. I don't know if it's the only thing or not. I just know that when we can remove ourselves from the divine and be able to discover our divinity, having been removed from our divinity, then we've become more than what we even thought we were in the first place, even when we were part of the divine, you know, primordial soup.
Oh, okay, then I have a question for you. You're getting me on this whole ascension thing and how you're explaining it. I'm really enjoying it. Ooh. Do children at a certain age have an innocence that understands the connection to their divine, and as they grow, they learn to disconnect from that?
It's funny you asked that.
Oh, yeah?
I'm glad you did, because this was in my brain as we were having a conversation earlier about children and life experience. I believe, I think almost anybody can agree with this, but I agree. I believe that we choose our parents or our life experience, or basically the framework that we grow up in as children, because children seem to almost like be at the whim of things, right?
Yeah, that'd kind of be like the moment we're born walking into the amusement park. We've chosen the amusement park as our life environment.
Right, exactly. You know, we're given a map, but for some reason we get put on a specific tram that's taken us to specific places.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Children don't seem to have as much. They're kind of learning how to become creators. They're learning how to do that, but they're doing so in a specific environment. That's the environment we've chosen to be in, right, as we are coming of age. And then when we become of age, we are now at the point where we have to break all that.
Hmm.
So in other words, we're instilled with these patterns of learning who we are identity-wise. We're learning who we are through these life experiences as children.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we do is we're presented with opportunities as adults as we drift out of childhood. We give these opportunities as adults that completely challenge who we thought we were.
Mm.
I mean, that's the whole thing. I think the whole design is, all right, you know, you've had this life experience as a child and you've learned this, and this is what the world appears like to you. Then you become an adult and the world says, yeah, no, it doesn't really work that way, so try something different. And you're like, but this is who I've learned that I am in the world. And they're like, yeah, but you have to be something different. It seems like everybody goes through that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the Native Americans had it right, and Aboriginal tribes have it right with the rites of passage.
Mm-hmm.
The rites of passage are, you know what, this is going to happen, and now it's time for you to challenge it and experience it, and so you know. Where we just do it because it's just we stumble and bumble and have frying pans hit in the face and all these other things. Did that make sense, what I just said?
Yeah. Basically, what you're saying is, I think that's basically just human experience right there. It's like school. You go to first grade, elementary school to learn the elementary aspects of world knowledge, such as basic math, basic how to write, how to use language, how to communicate. And then you get up to a higher level, such as middle school and high school, and you get more of an understanding of a more advanced understanding of the basics of the knowledge of the world. And then you hit college and or even technical school, and you realize that some of the things that you learned that you perceived in a certain way in elementary school aren't the same as they are now. I'll take one example. For years and years and years, everybody accepted that Pluto was a planet. And now people went through and they said, well, what? Let's define a planet more than we have in the past. And they said, oh, crap. If we define a planet like that, then that means Pluto is no longer a planet. That's kind of like one of those things where it's just like, well, that kind of shifts my whole perception of what a planet is, and I don't want to let Pluto go as a planet. And I think a lot of people, myself included, still consider Pluto a planet. Mm-hmm. And even though scientifically, from what we've decided, is categorically scientific in astrophysics and astronomy, that Pluto is not a planet, things have changed. And like, we did not expect this to happen. And
well, I like your analogy, but your analogy is almost too sterile.
Okay, sterile.
I'm gonna go with the extreme.
Okay.
You know, here I am, I'm born. My mother was extremely harsh and critical of me the whole time. I'm not saying me personally. I'm just saying that a person goes through life, they find that they're going through life and their mother was extremely harsh and critical of them and constantly disapproving. And so what they did was they did everything in their power to try to earn their mother's love and their mother just would not give it to them, right? So this person learned as a child, I am not deserving of love from a maternal figure, okay? They become an adult. And now, as an adult, all of a sudden, they keep finding themselves in scenarios which tell them, all right, now it's time to unlearn that. Now it's time to learn why you are deserving of love from a maternal figure. And the thing is you've had it so ingrained as a child to make that part of your identity. You may go through the rest of your life that way. Okay, say your life lesson is to learn unconditional love,
mm-hmm.
right? That's what you came in as an incarnate to do. What you're going to do as a child is you're going to actually experience the quite opposite. So you have to learn it from the undoing of it. You have to learn from the breaking of it, if that makes any sense.
Oh, you need the contrast.
You need the contrast. And the contrast is not like you don't learn a lesson through childhood because those are all the things that kind of create the structure. You learn it by breaking down the structure that you put in place and by unlearning it. And then your eyes become open and then you learn your identity. That's why I say the contrast is where the beauty lies.
Okay.
That's where when you said the conflict, you know, did we learn anything from it? But if you get trapped in it and you realize that you're nothing but just a victim of what was created for you in your childhood, then you don't really learn your creative potential. You don't learn your own godness. Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a question to go back to a main topic is throughout our life, we create neural pathways that connect and disconnect over time from one experience to another experience, from one thought to another thought, from one belief to another belief. And from what you're saying is we're programmed in a certain way as children and as we're growing up, and at some point we find out the rules that we can break that no longer apply as adults like they did as children, or like your example of growing up and not feeling like you were deserving of unconditional love, and then that's your programming. There's years and years of neural programming or neural pathways that have connected from almost every part of the body. If you all of a sudden lose your memory, your emotional makeup that is created by those neurons and those neural pathways, does that mean that you all of a sudden would be able to believe that you are worthy of unconditional love? And oh my goodness, lesson learned. That was our whole life lesson has just been accomplished through complete and utter amnesia. We're ready to ascend.
See, the whole reboot thing you talked about, the drive wipe thing, I don't know how possible that is because of what you just said. That was a really good point about the neural pathways. I think when those neural pathways and those patterns and those energies have been formed, there are some things that amnesia will make you go, oh, okay, well, you know, I don't remember, so I'm good. But there's other things that, no, not so much. There's kind of a little bit of wiring in there. And you might find yourself just kind of drifting towards something automatically.
So if we're hardwired from what we learn as we're growing up, it's really difficult for a lot of people to rewire and really, I mean, truly and honestly be able to perceive things differently from their basic wiring, from the experiences they had when they were growing up. And you know, you hear all the time that, oh yeah, you can be anything you want to do. You can do anything you want to do, but from your experiences of the whole life that you've lived and the thoughts and ideas that you've had up to this point, you're wired a certain way. It's almost like if you're built to be a car and you're wired to be a car, and then all of a sudden somebody says, you could be anything you want, and you're a car, and you want to be a jet. It's like, well, you can't be a jet because you're a car. Or you're a fish. We'll go back to your example then. It's like, you're a fish and you want to be an anteater for whatever reason. The universe says, sorry, you can't be an anteater because you're already a fish. And just like if we're so hardwired from what we learn when we're growing up, how realistic is it for us to be able to overhaul our whole belief system, our whole understanding of how things work in reality, to our perception of reality, to move from where we are to a different place, if that is our, that's our desire?
It's not supposed to be easy. easy is for chumps. I mean, it's like we always sit there, chase our whole lives trying to make everything easier. But what's the what is that all about? I mean, I think there's a difference between easy and just flow, like we talked about when we talk about flow, you know, when you remember we talked about this in sacred geometry, just kind of the finding the flow.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the difference here is that you learn to break it, because the thing is for you to find your flow, you've got to get past those obstacles and unlearn those things. If you don't unlearn those things, you're going to be stuck in this odd automaton. I'm the victim of my childhood, et cetera, et cetera. But if you learn to get past those things, when the obstacles come toward you, you see them as, oh, there's something in here that I need to get past to unlearn what I think I am. Once I do that, then I open myself up for so many more possibilities. And then I know how to just surrender and let the river carry me in the direction that I was born to go.
Okay, I see where you're going with that, but I think it would be extremely difficult for most people who have grown up as a certain gender to move past what they have learned and experienced as as one gender, such as, you know, you and I have lived our whole lives and our whole experiences and have a whole perception of reality through a male perspective.
How do you know?
How
do you know that's my history? How do you know I wasn't Debbie Deere until the age of 29? You don't know, do you?
You're right. I know you pretty well, but I don't know you that well.
You're right. I've been a boy. I've been a boy since I was born.
That's probably a good thing, unless you were a girl. But anyway, if we're raised in a certain way where cultural influences and experiences and what we're taught when we're raised of you're a boy, boys don't cry, boys stuff their emotions down, you know, boys are strong, you have to be strong, you have to provide for your family, da da da. These are lessons and things that we are taught culturally in America. If you're going to be a good guy, if you're going to be an upstanding male, this is what you need to do. What I'm saying is, from what you're saying, where going through being raised with these messages constantly being thrown at you, then you reach a point where, well, can we still be an upstanding guy? Can we still be a good male in this society if we don't do this, or if we haven't achieved that, or if we haven't completed that? I think that's what you're kind of talking about, where it's just like we're told and wired so specifically and so hardwired in such a way as we're growing up that, sure, it may not be easy to go from one gender to the other, or even to let go of some of that gender specific cultural programming. At the same time, do you want to? And if you do, does it open up new avenues for you? And I would say that yes, it would literally change your perception of reality. And that
but that's a blanket statement. That's to say that whatever programming is that you have to let go of. And I know it's not like I implied that. I'm just saying there's certain things. For example, let's say that you realize at a young age that you're gay.
Okay.
You're a gay male. And you've got this whole masculine perception. And I'm going to say that you're a more sensitive person as a gay male.
Okay.
And I'm just compounding it because you've got your sexuality and as well as this whole male archetype. I mean, there's a lot of very masculine gay men, so I'm just using this specific example.
Okay.
It's not a generalization. And so what you do is you find that, you know, you do like things, you know, you do, you're just, you're a little bit more feminine of a guy. And even if you're a straight guy and you're more feminine of a guy, I'm using the gay guys is because they have more of a challenge to break through, which is I'm a male and this is the way I'm supposed to be in society. I'm supposed to dig girls. I'm supposed to love football, all this other stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The thing is how many times have you seen somebody who is in the closet and they just seem like there is an anchor on them and they make bad decisions constantly. And then for some reason they come out of the closet and they seem to make better decisions. They seem to just be better, feel better about what they do. And they just kind of find themselves and they're more in the flow. Do you see what I'm saying there? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. That's the scenario that I'm talking about when you break it to really discover who you are.
Okay. So you're not talking about necessarily unlearning a huge chunk of things. You're just talking about specific things. In other words,
yes.
Let's take a general office setting. You're not talking about revamping and redecorating the whole office by taking out all the file cabinets, all the chairs, all the computers, all the tables, and everything like that. You're saying, you know what? As life progresses, maybe I want to try a different keyboard. Maybe I want to have a different monitor. Oh, well, now I'm in my 40s. Maybe I want a different filing system, so I'll get a different filing cabinet. Oh, now I'm in my 50s. You know, maybe I'll redo the carpeting because I've been looking at this carpeting my whole life. Is that more of what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. It's like if you become a product of your environment, and then throughout your entire adult life, you believe you are nothing but a product of your environment, how much more creative potential do you have, or how much more of your own creative potential do you recognize, your creative power do you recognize, as opposed to someone that said, I was raised and brought up and believed to be this way, and then I discovered, in spite of all that, that I was my own person in contrast to the way I was raised, you would believe that you could do anything.
Oh, yeah.
You see, that's what I'm talking about. And I think that's what it's there to say is that you're created to believe that you're this product of your environment, and then you realize that you're not. You find your own godness. I love that word, godness.
Your godness. I do like that, too. Your genius. Yo, I got my genius. Oh, yeah, genius. Genius.
Genius. Genius and genius. Ooh.
Ooh, interesting. Nice. That's like emotion, energy in motion.
Yeah.
Exactly. My genius. Genus. Can't say genus. That comes up with it. That could be genius or genus, or that can be a whole bunch of different things.
Wow, look at you.
There goes the word, the files in my brain saying, oh, find all possible words of this, of the G thing. It's a G thing. Then if you find the G spot in your life.
Wow. You're going back to the different.
Yeah. Well, okay, so. If you find the godness in your life, the G spot in your life, then
in yourself.
Yeah. Well, your life is part of yourself in yourself. And that's part of your life that affects your whole perception and reality and everything. Then yeah, it's literally having a religious experience, an epiphany or something like that. So basically, if we had to go back to the original question of, you know, if we lost all of our memory, if we lost all of our emotional wiring from growing up, would there still be any part of us that people that knew us would be able to recognize, or would we be something completely different? And from what it sounds like, what we're saying is that it would be very difficult to nearly impossible for any individual to completely 100% lose all of their wiring, all of their emotional baggage, all of their thoughts, all of their memories, and everything that has made them what they are up to that point in their life. Is that kind of what you're looking at, or did I miss something?
No, I think that's pretty accurate. I think we come into this to create an energetic impression on all that is. And I think that even if we do the reboot, the impression's still made. So I think that there's still going to be those pieces and parts of it. Because if everything is energy and everything just kind of makes its stamp and resides forever, in the all that is, then it doesn't matter if you're rebooted. It's that information has been made already, even with the reboot. And I think that you're still in certain energetic patterns, so you're still going to gravitate towards some of those things. You know, the memories and the small potatoes might get lost, but I think some of the big things might still be in grasp. There'd be an interesting case study, but I don't know. Good question.
I think as long as we're tied to our physical bodies, and our physical bodies are have experienced programming and stimulus and response learning experiences, that we are wired to a certain degree to be a certain way. I think once we get outside of the body, it's not so important, because we're not so concerned with third dimensional reality and what the lessons at this level of consciousness are that we need to learn. We're more of the full ocean instead of the just a drop in the bucket.
Right, exactly.
If that makes sense.
It makes sense to me, yeah.
Cool.
This is a good question. It was a really good question.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I think I was watching Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman. Yeah. Somebody said something, and I was like, oh, then what would happen if, and what would happen if, oh, then who are we? I don't know. Hey, David, do you want to do this as a topic?
Yeah.
So thank you very much. Yeah, I've been gnawing at the bit a little bit to get to it. So
oh, cool.
Do you have any final thoughts, or do you think we've covered it pretty closely?
No, my final thoughts might just muddle things up a little bit. So I think there's tons of good stuff to chew on in here, and we really kind of took this along a lot of winds and bends and things like that. And I think
we never.
I'm looking
that.
Forward to re-listening to that. Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. So I'm really curious as to see what it'll sound like when we play it back, because it did sound like it got tangential, but I think we had to really explore all the fine aspects of identity and what that entails. Is that really tied to the soul, or is it really tied to the body, or is it something inviolate, or is it something that you can do a do-over on? I think listening back on it will kind of help solidify some of that.
Yeah, and I find that is one of the really interesting things too, because I think you feel the same way to a large degree. When we're actually recording the episode, we're just going at the moment from, you said something, here's a thought, I'm presenting it. Oh, you said something, that produced a thought in me, now I'm presenting it. And then we go back and we listen to the episode and what we recorded, and like, oh, wow, that's actually really good.
Yeah, I think it's because the dialogue really just kind of opens up a lot of things. It opens up some of really high level awareness, as it were. And I don't mean high level in an arrogant way. I mean just high level as in just really not physically tied necessarily. It's like we say, we kind of channel it a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this was one of those where we kind of almost had free rein to do that.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did.
So, and of course, it's going to be a little bit, you know, tangential and curvy as a result of that, because it's you're talking about a topic like this one that is not a concrete, earthbound, three-dimensional topic. So it's going to take a while to try to take very multidimensional concepts and try to make them into just tangible vocabulary. It's really, it takes a lot of muscles, mental yeah. muscles to make that work.
And of course, you know, we come at it from the physical aspect, the emotional, the mental, the spiritual, the metaphysical, all these different areas. And, you know, we have to be careful to define a little bit, at least to see where, to make sure we're on the same page so the dialogue can continue. Mm-hmm. So.
And I'm going to leave. You did say I am going to leave with one little thought then.
Okay.
Here's my parting thought on this. With all that being said, I think there's a hint in all this when we say that we are always dead while we are alive.
Oh, interesting.
And I believe that wholeheartedly.
Very cool. Very cool. So for Take the Red Pill, I am Don.
You're Don Elam. I am Don Elam. Yeah, it kind of sounds Middle Eastern.
Yeah, I am Don Elam. Thank you for listening. So, David and I would like to thank all of our listeners. If this is the first episode you've listened to from David and I at Take the Red Pill, we thank you for taking the time. If you're a long-term listener, we thank you for your continued interest in our little project that we have here.
Absolutely. We really appreciate it. And we would love for you to visit our website, which is TakeTheRedPillPodcast.com, because we always put show notes on there. We put links to previous episodes, and we also put links to subjects and websites that have to do with the topic that we talked about. And if you want to be a regular subscriber of the show, go to iTunes and then search for Take the Red Pill under podcasts. You can find us there. You can subscribe. You can also email feedback@TakeTheRedPillPodcast.com to give us any suggestions, comments, anything you want on the show. We would love to hear from you.
And we have a Facebook page too, right?
We do. Yay. We do have a Facebook page. It's TTRP Podcast, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
Is that right? Is it, if you go facebook.com/TTRP Podcast?
I think we just recently got the name, other than just a bunch of numbers on there. Let me see.
If you type in Take the Red Pill, if you do a search in Facebook for Take the Red Pill, it will take you to our page. Look for the little kind of swirly nematode looking crop
circle.
Okay,
yeah, it is facebook.com/TTRP podcast.
You know, you think I should know this? I probably have said it right on 16 episodes, but I've kind of gone esoteric brain. So, TTRP podcast at the end of facebook.com, and it'll take you to our podcast page, or our Facebook page. There's actually a podcast player right there on our Facebook page. You can click right there and listen to the episodes while you're in Facebook, you know, saying, poking your friends.
Awesome. Very cool. So for Take the Red Pill, I am Donald Dalton, wishing you to be who you are.
And I am David Deere, and who you are is whoever you decide to be.